The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are the Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
When I hear that there is a democratic deficit in Europe and that Europe is not sufficiently democratic, I often comment. It's a bit like being on the moon and removing your helmet and saying, oh my God, there is an oxygen deficit. No, there's no oxygen deficit, there is no oxygen. So similarly, for me, in Brussels, my experience is there is no democratic deficit, there is no democracy.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, audio recordings of our live debates. In this edition, self-described erratic Marxist Yanis Varoufakis talks Europe, austerity and the threat to global stability.
For me, it is impossible to vote for an institution which has punished the people of Greece in the most grotesque way possible in front of the eyes of the rest of Europe and the world, not because it didn't have the money to sort out the Greek problems, but because they wanted to politically punish Greek politicians and Greek people.
Has the EU lost sight of its original purpose? Are weaker nations paying the debt of a financial crash which they did not cause? And as we see the rise of continental Euroscepticism and the EU becomes more fractured, is it time to reform? Joining Varoufakis to debate the issue are Green Party MP Caroline Lucas and leading figure of the international left, Tari Calley. Here's the chair, The Guardian's joint political editor, Heather Stewart.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this Guardian Live event. It's great to see such a packed hall. We've got a brilliant panel this evening to talk about the present and future of Europe. I'm Heather Stewart. I'm the political editor of The Guardian, or one of the political editors of The Guardian. It's a job share. And I'm delighted to be able to host this evening. It should be fun and lively, I think. So I'm going to kick off, without further ado, by introducing our panel and asking them each to talk a little bit fairly briefly about how they see the current situation in Europe and how that bears on our decision that we're all going to have to make on June the 23rd about Britain's future within the European Union. But let's start by introducing our great panel for this evening. So to my immediate left, almost needs no introduction, I'm sure, but Yanis Varoufakis, former Greek finance minister, and next to him is Caroline Lucas, the Green Party MP for Brighton Pavilion. On the far left is Tariq Ali, writer, journalist, filmmaker, Tribune of the Left, I'm tempted to say, who also has strong and interesting views on the future of the EU. So I'm going to start by asking, as I say, each of our panel members to just give a couple of minutes of their thoughts about the current situation in Europe. And Yanis Varoufakis, who's going to kick us off, has obviously experienced Europe's institutions at the absolute front line. So Yanis, perhaps you could start for us.
The state of the European Union.
I know, in 2 minutes, it's a bit much, isn't it? But
in 2 minutes.
Yeah. I might stretch to three.
Well, let me make it very succinct, otherwise I will not be able to keep within the 2 minutes even. It's in an awful state, the European Union. There is absolutely no doubt about that. It's in a disgraceful state. You only have to look at the European Union agreement with Turkey, which violates every principle of humanity, international legislation regarding the treatment of refugees. It has gone into bed with a very nasty government which is persecuting journalists. A few weeks ago, we had the great and the good amongst the leaders of the European Union at once imploring President Erdogan of Turkey to open the border of Turkey with Syria to let the Syrian refugees from war-torn Aleppo to come in, while at the very same time threatening the Greek government that if they don't close the border with Turkey, then Austrian policemen and women will go to the Greek-Macedonian border to seal Greece off the rest of the European Union. Need I say more? It is in an awful state. But the question is, what do we do about it? And my great worry is that if this awful European Union that we've ended up with, instead of the idealistic idea of an integrated Europe, if this awful European Union disintegrates further and Brexit would make it disintegrate further, the result would be an awful 1930s-like dystopia for the rest of us. So stay in the European Union so we can all fight together against Brussels and towards democratizing it. And just one last plug.
Absolutely.
Caroline and I are also members and founding members of Diem, the Democracy in Europe movement. We started it together on the 9th of February, worked together with many different movements in order to take the fight for democratization, which is a very utopian project, I have no doubt about that, but it is the only bulwark against the dystopia which is unfolding in front of our eyes.
And Caroline, it's, when you hear a dystopian picture like that, it's tempting, isn't it, to think, let's just walk away. That's one solution, isn't it?
It's a response and an understandable response, but I would certainly say it's not a solution because, yes, nobody would doubt that the EU is facing a major set of crises and it does suffer from a lack of support, a lack of effectiveness, and some degree a lack of legitimacy as well. But, you know, there are so many crises right now in the European Union and further afield, whether that's to do with terrorism or the refugee crisis or the climate crisis or the industrial scale tax evasion and avoidance that we're seeing right now. And I can't see how tackling those are going to be made any easier by our leaving the European Union. In fact, I think it'll make the world a lot more dangerous. So what I want to see is, yes, the kind of reform that Yanis has spoken about and which Diem is there really demonstrating that exists, that the will for that reform exists right across the European Union, not just in the UK but elsewhere. But I think as well we need to be making what you said was that high ideals argument, the visionary argument, inspirational argument, because we need to be saying not only what's wrong with the EU now, but how we want to change it, how the EU could be. And one of the things I think that frustrates me is that quite often the debate is actually rather muddled and rather lazy. And so, for example, you'll have people saying, well, you know, the EU is illegitimate because of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership Agreement, for example, this TTIP agreement. It is a horrible trade agreement that is absolutely going to allow private corporations to run roughshod over democratically elected governments. But the idea that we're going to have a softer, gentler, cuddlier trade policy if we withdraw from the EU, I think is cloud cuckoo land, because it is David Cameron, who is one of the loudest cheerleaders for TTIP. He is inserting that investor-state dispute settlement mechanism in future trade agreements. He certainly will, and successive governments have done that. So I think we need to be staying in Europe to change Europe. And I think there have been examples of where that has been successful. I think we can point to where the EU has made a positive difference. For example, at the Paris climate talks, where even if those outcomes weren't as positive as we might have hoped, nonetheless, they were a lot better than they might well have been. And many people there would have said that was not least to do with the role that the European Union played there. So let's not leave this referendum to the mainstream establishment voices. We've got to get out there talking to young people, talking to people about the Europe that we want to create. And as I say, not just us in the UK, but right across the EU as well.
Terry, we have to stay in order to try and reform Europe. We have to try and make, even if it's not the Europe that we want, we have to stay in and we have to try and make it the Europe that we want.
The question is, how do you change it? And Yanis and Caroline have made arguments that the best way to change it is by staying inside. Well, I agree with most of what they've said, except the tactical issue of how you vote. I mean, the aims are there. We agree on those. I think, actually, the best thing for Europe would be if Britain left, because all the opt-outs, all the pressures that have been put by the successive British governments on the Europeans, as Thatcher promised in her Bruges speech in 1988, I'm not going in there to allow a super state to be built that's going to run us. We're taking our views in there. And these views have been largely successful. The European Union today, as it functions, is effectively a machine for neoliberal capitalism, economically, and its politics flows from that. And for me, it is impossible to vote for an institution which has punished the people of Greece in the most grotesque way possible in front of the eyes of the rest of Europe and the world, not because it didn't have the money to sort out the Greek problems. They did. It was a piffling amount. But because they wanted to politically punish Greek politicians and Greek people. They've done similar things in Ireland with the support of the elite, similar things in Portugal. We talk about refugees. How many people talk about up to 1 million people, young people who've been forced and old people who've been forced to leave Portugal because of the austerity measures? Or the fact that 1 in 4 young people in Ireland are emigrating again. They're refugees too. So for me, the best way to fight to create a new Europe is to force some recognition in Brussels that it's a very serious situation. And I think Britain withdrawing will be helpful from that point of view to restart and reopen a new discussion. It's as simple as that. For me, it's a tactical issue which way to vote. It's not to paint Europe in sort of golden colors, it's the new gold standard. No one is saying that. It's a tactical issue, and I think the tactics at the present time are to punish the EU bureaucracy, to force them to think, and that will happen if there is a Brexit, regardless of all the forces engaged on either side, many of whom are, you know, people I could never support, either Cameron or Farage and Boris Johnson and people.
That's a direct challenge to you, Alex. Aren't you effectively arguing for the persistence of exactly the elites and the sort of machinery that in some ways chewed you up and spat you out?
The person who was perhaps more than anyone else at the receiving end of this orchestrated brutality.
Precisely, yeah.
I think I can comment on this, Derek. What you've been saying, of course, is the kind of debate that I've had in Greece many times with friends and comrades who were discussing along the same lines that you are proposing Brexit, Grexit. So they were saying to me that, you know, see how they're treating us. There is absolutely no sense in trying to reform the European Union by staying in when there is absolutely no room for a rational conversation. But I will take you up on the challenge of talking about tactics. Because my great disagreement with those comrades of mine who were recommending Grexit was that from the perspective of the European Union institutions, the bureaucrats, the neoliberal politicians that are in cahoots with these bureaucrats, the worst thing that we could have done against them, their greatest fear, was not that we would up stumps and leave, but that we would default within. The great weapon that we had in my ministry, that I had as a finance minister, was not the threat of getting out of the Eurozone, for instance. The greatest threat is, I'm not going anywhere, but you know what? If you close down my banks, I'm going immediately to haircut the bonds of the Greek state that you own, my debt to you. And that to them was a much greater threat than the non-credible or the very difficult political threat of arguing that we should leave. So I'm not proposing that we should stay, that the Greeks should stay or the Brits should stay in the European Union to reform it. This beast cannot be reformed on the basis of rational argument. When I was putting to them rational arguments, it felt as if I was singing the Swedish national anthem. And they were utterly impervious to rational debate. But they are not impervious to civil and state disobedience within the European Union. So my suggestion is, elect the Labour Party government. And a Green government.
I think we're getting a sense of our audience, aren't we? But yeah.
Elect anti-establishment governments throughout Europe, and then have those governments do what we try to do, what I try to do, which is to a campaign of state disobedience within Brussels, within the institutions, saying, we're going to veto the hell out of every European Union Council, every ECOFIN, every Eurogroup, until we have the debate that Europe has not had. And why am I so keen on the campaign of disobedience in order to bring about a completely transformed, revolutionized European Union? And this is where I'd love to hear Tarek and Caroline tell me what they think about my perspective on this. Look, it's a great mistake to think that the European Union is something terrible out there, which is constant and a given, and you've got to decide whether tactically you should be part of it or not. It is not a constant and a given. It is a disintegrating mess. This process, however, of disintegration, if we speed it up through Grexit or Brexit, and Brexit will speed it up, this disintegration, what is it going to do? Is it going to empower progressive forces in Britain, in France, in Greece, in Germany, in Portugal, in Spain? Or is it going to empower the bigots, the xenophobes, the racists, the UKIPs, the Le Pens, the Golden Dawns, and the ultranationalists? I bet you it will do the opposite, because the European Union disintegration is going to lead very quickly to a fault line developing along the Rhine River and across the Alps between a Germanic northeast Calvinist Europe, which is going to go straight into a deflationary vortex because the new Deutschmark will go through the roof. The rest of Europe, of continental Europe, is going to go stagflationary, high inflation as their new currencies devalue.
It's the old economic divide within Europe.
The old economic, but this time it will be a new 1930s in terms of aggregate demand collapsing throughout, sucking Britain into it, and the people who are going to be empowered by this would not be the progressives in Britain, would not be the Tarek Ali's, it will be the Eurosceptic part of the Tory party, UKIP, the British National Party. They are the only ones who will benefit. If I am right in this assessment, we have a political duty to do that which the left failed to do in 1930, which is to build a pan-European democratic movement to stop the slide into the abyss. So stay in and let's fight together against Brussels. Not to reform it, but through a campaign of state disobedience.
Sorry, that's a challenge to you, isn't it, really? That you, if we withdraw, you get complete chaos, and who benefits out of chaos? It's not the left, it's the right.
But you won't get chaos. Why do you think you'll get chaos? I mean, let's be totally down to earth here. In terms of the British economy, even the Economist agrees, which is very pro-European, pro-European Union, because I am pro-European, I'm not pro the European Union. Mm. What is being argued very clearly by serious people who don't have an axe to grind or are even pro-European, that economically it'll make very little difference to Britain, whether it's in Europe or out of Europe. In fact, there will no longer be any excuse for blaming every local disaster on the European Union, as is now constantly done by the right and the far right. Mm. You will have your own government of whatever sort, and you will see what that government is doing. This notion that we will elect progressive governments all over Europe and they will transform the EU, well, it's utopian. It really is utopian, given the situation. And hang on, you know, I'm just answering some of Yanis's points. Then you can answer mine, then I'll answer yours, then he'll speak, then I'll answer his.
Yeah, that's the general idea, and then we might answer some of theirs.
And we have
point,
the audience as well. Yeah, because the notion that the far right is about to take over, it is in some countries. I think France is the most dangerous. But let's ask, under what rubric did this far right get so strong? How? It was under the rubric of the European Union, which didn't have a clue, or did have some clues as to which direction it was going, created this huge vacuum by prohibiting even the mildest form of social democracy. It was not acceptable in Greece, not acceptable here. So you have this vacuum, which the left is virtually absent, or capitulates, or runs away from, and the right becomes more and more powerful. Why are so many white working class people voting for the Front National in France? Why are they doing that in Germany now? This has not been created by being out of the EU, it's been created by being in the EU.
Caroline.
But I think Tarek is using the EU in exactly the way that he says he isn't going to use it. In other words, he is using the EU as the scapegoat for all of the ills in the world.
No.
The EU is made up of the 28 member states who actually do have a very big say in the policies that come out of the European Union. And if we elect between us across the European Union a majority of right-wing bigoted governments, guess what? You get right-wing bigoted policies coming out of the EU. That is not a mystery. That is a logic. So that does take us back to what Yanis said, in a sense, that there is a responsibility on all of us to be fighting in our different member states for more progressive governments. But let's make the distinction between the European Union as a set of institutions and the current drivers, the current people around the council table who are making the decisions. We put them there indirectly because we, or indeed directly, because we elected whatever governments we now sadly have in place. And that is why it's responsible on us to make sure that we do fight for better governments to send to Europe. Because I remember a time in the 1980s, they were halcyon days, when there was a majority within the EU15, there were a majority of Green Party environment ministers. It didn't last very long, but while it did last, you know what? There was some really good environment policy that came out of the European Union. So let us make a distinction between the institutions and the member states. So when we're talking about refugees, for example, let's not forget that actually the most European bit, if you like, of the EU institutions, in other words, the Commission, did actually come up with a rational, reasonable way of sharing responsibility for the refugees who are coming into Europe. And it was the individual member state governments who threw it back in their face and said, we're not doing that, we're erecting fences. Now, that is not the fault of the EU, that is the fault of European governments who are not rising to the challenge, the biggest challenge that they've faced in decades. So make a distinction, first of all, between the institution and the current drivers of that institution. And I think as well that Tariq's solution is such a drastic one. I mean, it really is cutting off your nose to spite your face. It really is, you know, hanging yourself to make a point. I think that we would have chaos, not just economically, but when I think about the area that I know best on environmental policy, if I see what I think would happen in this country, if we didn't have the EU there pushing us to go further when it comes to you know, the quality of our air or our seas or our water, the EU has played an incredibly positive role in that, in terms of energy, in terms of renewable energy, energy efficiency. And the idea that we're suddenly going to find ourselves in a better world if we withdraw from the EU, I think, is absolutely unfounded by the evidence.
But Yanis, on economic policy, things are rather different, right?
Just allow, Tariq made two excellent points.
Yeah.
And I want to grant those points, but argue that they do not support his conclusion. The first excellent point he made was that, let's say that on 23rd June, Brexit wins. I am not a fearmonger. I am not saying that the next day Britain is going to go down the drain. No. I do not share this fearmongering that, oh, the moment we vote to get out, all hell will break loose in Britain and British economy is going to collapse. Probably nothing will happen for a long while. So I agree with you on this. Secondly, another excellent point he made, the second excellent point, was that indeed the collapse of the dream of shared prosperity in the continent is due to the neoliberal depoliticization of political decision-making, which is effectively creating toxic right-wing policies that fail and create a slow-burning depression in the heart of Europe, giving rise to Le Pen. So these two points I grant to Tariq completely, but they don't lead to your conclusion, I don't think. Because my argument is not that if Britain comes out, the British economy will suddenly collapse. My argument is that the European Union's disintegration will speed up. Maybe this is something you want, because you think that we better... I mean, my friend Norman Lamont thinks exactly the same thing. No, he's a friend of mine, so... it's a strong intellectual argument that the European Union is a terrible institution. We might as well allow it to disintegrate and build a new Europe from the beginning. That's what Norman says, and I think this is what Tariq says. Maybe they mean differently, but this is more or less the same argument. But my disagreement is that the disintegration that at the moment, the process of neoliberal toxic economic policies, policy formation in the EU, on the continent, that has been unfolding now for 20 years, is reaching a critical moment, independently of Brexit or not. It's reaching a critical moment. And I think that when the camel's back gets broken by the last straw, which I don't know which exactly it will be, at that moment, you will find that in France, in Germany, in Holland, in Denmark, in Greece, even in Italy and in Spain, you are going to have a real conflict, a moment of truth, when the forces of the ultra-right, the Northern Leagues, various rather brutish forces within Europe, are going to be on the cusp of some kind of success at gaining government, at poisoning the political scene further in Europe. While, and this, what is going to give them that oxygen to do it, that fuel, will be the disintegration of the political scene in Europe that will be sped up by Brexit. So my great worry is that, even though you're right, terrible things have been happening because of the European Union policies, the way we were squeezed in Greece last summer. Brexit is still going to contribute to developments in Europe, which we may have a chance, there are no guarantees, if Britain stays in, we may have a chance, just may have a chance to prevent. Brexit is not going to do this, and you know, Tarek, I really don't believe that a victory for the Leave campaign is going to strengthen the internationalist mindset of the British working class. If anything, it will do precisely the opposite, and people like you and me are going to lose the audience that we already have in this country.
But what's your argument for the idea that that crisis is going to come? Because you, in some ways you can argue that Greece's capitulation, Greece's sort of loss of that argument, was a triumph for the austerity policies, for neoliberal policies, for, you know, you stood up against it and you lost. In some ways you can say that, you know, the elite triumph. Those ideas have been amazingly, you know, long-lasting, notwithstanding the crash, notwithstanding the kind of misery that's been inflicted on Greece and Portugal and others. You know, in some ways, aren't those ideas of austerity and neoliberalism still riding high in Europe? What makes you think that collapse is coming?
I've written extensively about that in your newspaper as well.
Indeed.
So,
indeed.
Obviously, this is precisely what is happening. But the question is, what do we do? How do we respond to that? And I feel we have a very stark choice. We accelerate this process by removing our countries from the center of the continent, which is where these developments are happening, or we stay in to try to fight in the way we should have fought in the 1930s, across different political borders, across national borders, even across party lines, in order to do our best to impede this slide and this evolution that you so vividly described.
Mm. Caroline, what about institutions? It's pretty undemocratic, isn't it? EU as it operates at the moment, you talk about governments.
We're sitting in a country where our government had 24% of the popular vote. So don't tell me about the EU being undemocratic. You know, we have our own house to get in order as well. And yes, of course, it's not as democratic as it should be. And there are measures underway to try to address some of that. I mean, take the European Parliament. Actually, that is elected in this country under a system of proportional representation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So arguably, your MEPs are more representative of the votes cast than MPs. So that's one point. Mm. The second point is that the Parliament is increasingly gaining more powers, and again, not enough, and it's a slow process, but at each treaty negotiation, the Parliament does achieve more powers. The Commission, yes, is not sufficiently transparent and accountable, but there are really straightforward measures that, in fact, Diem has been setting out exactly how you could introduce things tomorrow. You could, for example, make sure that all of the meetings were live streamed. You could make sure that all of the documents were accessible. You could make sure, though, too, and let's not keep blaming the EU. We in this country, in Westminster, across the road, could be demanding that our ministers come to Parliament before they go to the Council of Ministers or Ministerial Councils and tell us in advance what they're going to be negotiating, and we discuss it and we have an input into it, as they do in many other European countries. We in the UK, we just sit and wait for the minister to come back and then slag him off. And it usually is him.
And usually he briefs the press that he's scored an absolute triumph against the forces of Brussels, is how it usually works. But we're not talking here about a kind of tearing down of institutions. That's what I'm wondering. We're not talking about a fundamental kind of rewriting of the structure. No, we're talking about
better policies, different policies. I think we're talking about something incremental. No, I think we are talking about all of that, actually. But what I wanted to say, I guess, was that the way Diem sets it out is that in having short-term changes you can make tomorrow, if the political will were there, and that in a sense is what I've been describing. But yes, certainly we also need structural changes too. I want to see environment and sustainability policy right up there as the number one, aim of the union rather than a very narrowly defined economic growth. So yes, those structural changes need to happen as well, and bigger structures need to change when it comes to making sure that the institutions, all of them, are more accountable to the people. And DiEM sets out ideas about how you could have a people's constitutional process to do that. The reason I started with some of the smaller changes was just to demonstrate that actually there are a whole range of things we could be doing if the political will were there to start on this mission. And that is exactly what DiEM is stirring up, I think.
Tariq, it's reformable. There are things we can do. It's democratic. It's reformable.
It's not democratic. That is one thing I would challenge very sharply. The European Parliament has very little powers. If the Commission and the Council decide on A, B, and C, there is no way, I'm sorry, there is no way in which the European Parliament can overrule them.
That is simply not true. I have been a member of the European Parliament, and if, for example, the European Parliament voted against TTIP, TTIP would not proceed.
But what difference has it made? That's the point I'm making. You have no powers to insist on it because they're negotiating secretly on TTIP.
That's who you've elected. That isn't to do with... If you elected some progressive politicians, they have the power, the democratic capacity is there for them to vote down TTIP.
I didn't interrupt you, but it's fine. But don't worry. But what I'm trying to say to you is that you were a member of the European Parliament, which was a parliament with very little power to affect anything that the EU did as an institution. Surely you must have realized that in your period there. I mean, how could you not? So you can oppose TTIP, but the negotiations on that are still being carried out. And when they're carried out and signed, you can still go into the European Parliament and say, we don't agree. It makes no difference at all.
The power is there for the European Parliament to veto
it. It is not the sovereign body of Europe.
No, because there isn't a sovereign body of Europe. No. There are three different parts. It's a tripartite institution.
There's the government ministers who control everything. There's the bureaucrats who dominate the Europe. The European governments dominate the Council. The bureaucrats run the Commission. And then there is this Parliament, which is largely a talk shop with very little powers. Come on.
Can you break through this?
Because it just simply isn't true.
It's not very often that I play the role of the bridge maker.
I know. I thought it could be your moment.
But I shall try. I shall try. I will agree with Tariq here, Caroline. I've often used a metaphor. I say that when I hear that there is a democratic deficit in Europe and that the Europe is not sufficiently democratic, I often comment. It's a bit like being on the moon and removing your helmet and saying, oh my God, there is an oxygen deficit. No, there's no oxygen deficit. There is no oxygen. So similarly, for me, in Brussels, my experience is there is no democratic deficit, there is no democracy.
That's you building a bridge, is it?
Yeah. This is me building bridges with Tariq. But where I agree with Caroline entirely is that the solution is not to say, okay, let's tear it up now and let's go back to our nation state where we have democracy. I don't believe that is that is a coherent notion. Because, Tariq, if you and I were sitting together with Caroline and we were planning the way that the British constitution should be reformed after the removal of Britain from the European Union, maybe it would be fun to do, and maybe we could have created a democratic House of Commons here. But the powers that will win on the 23rd of June, if Brexit succeeds, are not the ones who will reconstitute democratic sovereignty in this country. Yeah. Remember, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, who will be in power if Brexit wins? You will not be in power, they will be in power. They want to stay in the single market. Now, what does that mean? It means they want to maintain common industry standards with the EU, common labor market protections with the EU, and common environmental protection with the EU. Now, to have these three commonalities, you need to have common legislature or legislative powers, powers to legislate over these three realms, common executive powers, and common judiciary, which means effectively you need a state, a common state to have the single market. So they are proposing, the Brexiters, it's not you, it's them. Boris Johnson will be prime minister. Yes, I know. It's scary. Yeah? And they want to stay in the single market, which effectively what they want to do is they want to maintain sovereignty in the hands of Brussels, but without British people, British representatives, being able to go to Brussels and carry out what I consider to be essential, which is the campaign of disobedience against Brussels. So this is the great fear, that Brexit will not be an exit from the neoliberal European Union to a democratic Britain. It will be a halfway house, which is effectively worse, the worst of all possible worlds.
I'm not sure it'll be worse. Yanis, I'm not sure it'll be worse. You yourself have made the argument for suggesting that it'll more or less be the same. I mean, you know, the Norwegians and the Swiss have the same deals with the European Union, which the British industrialists and rulers will impose. So economically, for those who support the way the economy is being run, which I don't, but for them, it won't make any difference at all.
But we won't be at the table having any say over the way those rules are being defined. So if we...
If Caroline and Jeremy form a government after Brexit, they will not be able to change labour market rules and environmental protection rules because they will not have a seat at Brussels. They will not be able to say, we will veto everything under the sun until you yield on these issues.
No, but what they could do is to say then that we are going to pass rules regardless of what the EU TTIP have agreed, in which we strengthen collective bargaining rights and we do not allow workers from abroad who come here temporarily or semi-permanently to work on low wages, the wages they are paid in their countries, because contractors bring them over. That you will be able to do if you have a radical, or even a mildly radical government in this.
But that you still can. You can do that now.
That you can do now.
What?
When Jeremy and I take power in a few months' time, we can do that now.
Okay.
So you don't need to leave the EU to do that.
Well, you know, the main argument I put forward at the beginning for leaving the EU, A, that economically it didn't matter, and B, that politically, actually, given that Britain has been the most reactionary state in the European Union, its departure could only help progressives elsewhere in Europe. I mean, that's just a fact. And I've been arguing for this for a long, long time in front of British
officials. Why don't you, instead of leaving, elect Jeremy and Caroline?
Yeah, well, but it's... I mean, that is a very good possibility, and I support it wholeheartedly. But let's also stop talking about Britain. Because if there's a Brexit, there'll be an exit in the north of Britain by the Scots. So you will not have Britain, and there's English politics, there's Scottish politics.
So that's what you're doing. You're working for the Scottish National Party.
Yeah.
Can I just, I'm really keen to throw it open because I really want to get some questions. Can I just ask you, before we do that, Yanis, just quickly about the global perspective, which I know is something that you look at in your book. You talk about this kind of collapse, this unravelling of Europe. What will be the impact of that beyond the EU?
Pure awfulness. Remember the credit crunch, 2008? The Great Recession, the implosion of finance everywhere, in the West at least. What happened at that point was two things. Two things saved capitalism from capitalists, from financialized capital. One was that central banks started printing mountains of money to replace the paper values, pseudo values that combusted. Some of them are still doing it, the ECB in particular. And secondly, emerging markets, China, Brazil and so on, borrowed a very large proportion of that printed money in order to create bubbles that supported the West and prevented the West from collapsing. So Germany's net exports were diverted from collapsing Europe to China. And China was creating intentionally a bubble in order to reflate and to rebalance the world economy. So the emerging markets, effectively, to a large extent, sacrificed themselves by creating the bubbles which they knew would eventually deflate on our behalf, on behalf of the West. Now, those bubbles are collapsing. So you've got the emerging markets, what we used to call the third world, the developing world, the emerging markets, call them what you will. They are entering a pretty horrendous period. There's a perfect storm there. At the same time, you have the commodity cycle turning against them, with the prices of commodities that they sell collapsing, while the dollar is increasing and all their debt is dollarized. Mm. So we are facing a new wave of global capitalist crisis coming from the emerging markets. America is teetering on the brink. They've stabilized, but they are not in the business of actually investment-led growth. If Europe, which is the largest economic bloc in the world, goes down the path that I described before, if we allow European Union disintegration, which will be sped up, in my estimation, by Brexit, to continue, we are in the first stages of a new massive world global period of instability and crisis, from which the people of Brazil, the people of China, the people of India, the people of Pakistan, together with the people of the European periphery, the north of England, are going to suffer collectively. This is why I'm so agitated about the importance of progressives banding together throughout Europe to stabilize Europe. Europe is perfectly capable, for a third time in the last 100 years or so, to do untold damage to the global economy. To the planet.
Jan, is this all you could say without the European Union even being in existence? I mean, you know, you've given a very good survey of the economic crisis of capitalism, and I agree with you. There is no way in which I see the European Union changing or even restricting that. I mean, the collapse of 2008 is still with us. They haven't learned any lessons at all, either on the European or the national levels. You know, the elites are still living in this bubble. So this has got very little to do with Brexit or no Brexit or Grexit or anything else. This is a real serious crisis.
It does. That fault line between France and Germany, if we allow it to happen and Brexit would speed it up, is going to make a bad thing far, far worse. Tarek, allow me one last attempt to convince you.
Not a third world war. Don't go down that road.
I just want to make one last bid to convince you. I know it will fail, but I want to make it.
Okay.
You have excellent arguments as to why we should not have created the European Union that we created.
Yes.
But I'm making the point that even though I agree with you, disintegrating what we have is not going to take us to where we would have been had we not created. The difference between statics and dynamics. The dynamic would be vicious if we try to return to where we should have been had we not created.
But Janesh, okay. It's disintegrating already without anything having happened. I mean, as we can see,
and we must stop this because
we don't have the powers to stop it.
Will lead to the 1930s all over again.
No.
Well, I think on that apocalyptic note, it would be great if we could throw it open. There are some mics roaming around, and if we can, we're going to take blocks of three questions at a time. There's a gentleman right down here in the front row, and there's a chap here. Is there anyone over there for that mic? Yeah, this gentleman as far away from the mic as he can get. Very good. Gentleman in the front row.
Okay, firstly, can I just thank the panel for the first intelligent debate on Europe I've heard for a very long time. Gosh. But my question is, in the disintegration of Europe, whether it's speeded up by Brexit or not, why does Ms. Lucas and Mr. Varoufakis seem to think that the right will win?
Interesting. Okay. And gentlemen here?
I've got two quick questions. I mean, one on a strategy point. If the UK was not in the EU 40 years ago and been breaking down any federalist and integrating options and slowing down the integration of Europe, would a federal Europe be in a better position to have reacted to Greek and other crises, current crises?
That's if the UK hadn't been a member?
Yeah. And the second question, when you said that the Brexit wouldn't have a massive economical impact. I mean, for the moment, all the trade agreements that the UK is using to trade with the world are based on the EU agreement. Mm. So getting out of that would put the UK in a position where they have suddenly have to renegotiate agreement with the rest of the world. And if in 2 years you have to negotiate the with the rest
we'd
of the world, you really,
start
really bend
again.
Over.
Yep, okay, and then...
Hello.
Gentleman over here.
I think I forgot my question now. But Tariq Ali, if you could just comment, I mean, I believe everything you said with regards to Brexit, and I'm just not convinced about, you know, fascism taking hold of Europe after Brexit. But what about some of the points that Caroline made about the common environmental policies and fisheries and so on, perhaps defence as well? Would you like to make some comments on that for us who are in favour of Brexit, certainly?
Okay, good. So why would we think that the right would win?
The disintegration of European Union that was built like a cartel with a gold standard-like terrible currency is going to lead to major deflationary tendencies and forces. Deflation and recession always traditionally favors the ultra-right, never the left. Look at every experience in the world. They are not revolutionary times. They are counter-revolutionary times. They are the kind of developments that feed scapegoating, xenophobia, and the retreat to a kind of invocation to kin, which is the first step towards fascism.
Okay, and did you want to come back on that one?
I do. I don't agree that there is a serious danger of fascism in Europe, for God's sake. There are right-wing parties, there is xenophobia. But the notion that we're on the verge of fascism without there being any threat to the elites from the left at all, it's cuckoo land. It's not real. There is a danger that the chauvinist right, in the absence of left forces pushing forward and arguing for policies which are transformative, could gain. But then that's our fault partially. I mean, you know, no one asked Alexis Tsipras to capitulate in the way he did. He did it. And that sort of activity is what encourages the right and strengthens it. But I don't think there is any basic material reason for fascism as such, as we have known it, to triumph in the Europe of today. And none of us have talked about the big power, the United States of America, which is the dominant power today, and which also is pretty dominant in Europe, militarily, philosophically, culturally, very determining policies on all these things. So it's not the case of sovereignty or not sovereignty, and that's why I attack the right here very hard, to say it'll be a sovereign Britain if we Brexit. It won't be, because you lost your sovereignty long before you were in the EU when you decided to become an American satrapy.
Did you want to take on, as part of that, while we're sort of on that subject of sovereignty, did you want to take on this other question about what about some of the more progressive things that the EU does, or whether it's on fisheries policy you talked about, to do the environment, other things? Wouldn't we lose some of the benefits we get from that if we left?
Well, it depends, again, on what government is elected. I mean, as many of us are hoping, the Tories will suffer, even if they win. The Tory party will split. Historically, this party has not split, ever. Labour has split, the Lib Dems have split, but the Conservative Party has been a continuous force, political force in this country. And quite honestly, if that was one of the side effects of Brexit, a split in the Conservative Party, I wouldn't be too upset. I mean, all the different factions of it could then openly set up companies in Panama, was it? Or profit from what's going on in Ireland. They can do it openly, no need to pretend. We're busy making money. Forget politics. So that would be one of the side effects of it. And of course, look, Naomi Klein in her last book, with which I agree very much, made a very strong argument that forget about doing anything. She didn't say forget about it, but she said we can't do anything serious on the environment unless it is organized internationally and unless it understands that you need some form of planning in society. If we're going to do away with that, it's not just Europe, it's China, it's India, it's Australia, it's the United States.
Caroline.
I am quite sure that if you were to say to Naomi Klein, okay, so we want to have environmental policy organised on an international level, we'd all agree with that.
Yeah.
But would she actually say, on the step on the road to that, let's actually stop doing environment at the EU level, I'm pretty sure she would say no.
It.
Because it is incredibly
just
important.
Just demagogy, Caroline. I'm not saying we stop doing it.
Well, you are. You're saying you don't care if we withdraw from the EU
care.
Because you don't think it's going to make much difference to the environment. The point I want to make is that it would make a very big difference to our environment, not least because there are so many environmental problems that are, by their nature, cross-border. You know, when it comes to air pollution or marine pollution, or even when it comes to coming together to tackle climate change, you need to be working together to have the kind of effect and the influence around the table globally. The idea that we would have the same influence as one country internationally is just, I think, not borne out by
the evidence.
The people
who make this argument most strongly... The people who make this argument most strongly are the Germans. You know, many, many people in Germany, and they're correct. And that is also the country that has given us the Volkswagen scandal with the emissions. Let's not forget, which
that's,
is
that's
one
a
of the.
Non-sequitur.
I'm saying that, you know, it is a bit utopian to talk about the environment under the form of capitalism we have today, unregulated. Completely free, which dominates this world. I mean, you know, it then does become utopia.
Our best chance of being able to try to rein in unleashed capitalism is precisely by working at European Union level.
But that's where the problem lies.
Where is energy now going into, for example, the Tobin tax, the tax on speculative capital movements? It's happening in the EU and Britain is blocking it. Where are we absolutely trying now, at least, to clamp down on bankers' bonuses? In the EU, Britain is blocking it. When it comes to tax dodging and tax evasion, the EU is going far further than the British government. So let us not throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I want to come back.
Can
I just do think that Tariq's position on the whole issue of fascism in Europe is complacent. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago we would have seen the scenes we've seen right now with the fences going up, with refugees being forcibly turned back. You know, those images on our television screens shame us all, but for me that is an argument for more European solidarity, not for thinking that if we walk away and have Boris Johnson in charge, we're going to be any better off.
Yanis, could you take on this... There's a sort of slightly intriguing argument here that by blocking all these things and sort of throwing sand in the wheels of the federalist project, Britain has actually left the EU less able to respond to crises like Greece and so on. Because it's not the kind of
I actually
project,
profoundly disagree that the worst enemy of federalism in Europe was Britain. Actually, it was France. France demanded the right to run Europe using the Deutschmark without federation and without... The difference between the French and the Germans... Elites, I mean, not the people, is that the German elites wanted to lose themselves in a uniting Europe, whereas the French wanted to extend the reach of the French nation state using the Deutschmark. And so I disagree with you on this. But let me make the point that, Tariq, I think there is nothing more utopian than to think that Brexit is going to bring about a split in the Tory party. The Tory party is extremely united in the pursuit of the interests of the ruling class in this country. Nothing is going to split them apart. Nothing.
All right, let's take some more questions, can we? let's see.
Let's try it and see.
Yeah.
Almost worth it.
It's all about tactics, isn't it?
It will come at a very hefty price.
Gentleman here with a sort of purple jumper on, I can see. Lady there, I can see. And right up the back. Yeah, just there. Perfect.
Hi. Tariq, you think we can leave the EU and get back in? I don't think that could happen, really. But if we did, I want to ask, would they let us back in the first place? If they would, how long would it take? Would it be 10 years, 20 years? And lastly, would it be any different to the current EU that we have now?
And there's the lady there.
I wanted to ask about doctrine of European defence. Paul Mason's just written an article this week suggesting that the Labour Party needs to keep both Trident and nuclear weapons. And it needs to do this in order to be taken seriously, and it needs to be taken seriously in order that he can get elected to make economic transformation. And I just wondered what you thought about that relationship between winning economic transformation only through keeping Trident and nuclear submarines.
Look, Paul Mason is a good friend of mine. I would step in and say that Paul is a good friend of mine. I'll tell him off in private.
I'd like to hear in public Caroline Lucas has to say about that particularly, please.
Excellent, excellent idea. And let's just get that third question and then we'll do that.
Yeah, I'll tell him now.
If you want to ask about Paul Mason, he's made a complete fool of himself by pushing forward this argument because it's not a question of left or right.
Large numbers of people in this country on left and right are opposed to Trident and opposed to having a nuclear presence in this country.
Political party splitting, let's not get into the Trident argument quite yet. Let's just take the third question from this chat and then we'll come back.
During the referendum on Scotland, there was quite a lot of airtime given over here, sort of pleading with our friends north of the border to stay. Mm-hmm. If we were to cast a vote amongst the Europeans on the other side of the English Channel, would they like England to stay or to leave?
Very interesting question. Where should we start? Yanis, do you think we would be, would our friends on the continent be coming over and...
Well, look, I'm a Greek. I'm here and I'm campaigning for you to stay in. We want you in.
What more do you want?
European Democrats want British Democrats in to forge an alliance against Brussels.
But Yanis, the Greece is divided on this with great respect, and I love you very much, but you don't speak on behalf of everyone in Greece.
The vast majority. The vast majority. I can assure you, if there was a poll among Greeks, especially amongst progressive Greeks, do we want Britain in or out?
We get
90% amongst progressives and we would get 60-70% amongst the overall population of people wanting Britain to stay in.
Caroline, let's take on this knotty issue of Trident. We need a nuclear deterrent because without nuclear weapons we can't be taken seriously politically, and if we can't be taken seriously politically, we can't win the argument.
What Paul Mason said, I have a huge degree of respect for Paul Mason, but I don't know what he was on when he said this, but it was just to be quite extraordinary,
right?
Exactly. I mean, it's just such an incoherent argument. I don't really honestly see where he's coming from on this at all. The idea that your economic robustness is going to be dependent on spending £100 billion on nuclear weapons over the next 30 years seems to me to be extremely odd.
No, he said the credibility of the Labour Party will be enhanced by espousing that, and that is an argument.
Which is why Labour's been espousing it for X number of years,
it is. One of the interesting things about Tony Blair's autobiography was when he absolutely says that we could have gone either way on it, but actually, do you know what, just in terms of our status and our position, you know, we better keep with it. But you know, I think there is the potential here to turn the tide, because I think it isn't just people on the left who think that spending huge amounts of money on weapons that hopefully we would never use, but if we did, would just be so catastrophic, one could hardly imagine it. There are the army generals who would say the same thing. I mean, they would like to use the finance freed up by Trident for something very different from what I would like to use it for, but nonetheless, there are plenty of people in the military who are thinking that spending all of this money on these weapons is crazy, that with the advance of things like underwater drones and so forth, by the time we actually get the new weapons out and being used, they're going to be incredibly vulnerable to attack. That the real security threats that we face today are not likely to be state-on-state nuclear war, but actually are to do with the terrorist threat or the climate threat or all kinds of things where nuclear weapons are not going to be helpful. So 99% of the time I agree with Paul Mason, but I don't know what he was doing with this 1%.
Tarek, did you want to take on that and also this other question that was specifically directed at you?
I just want to make one point. Yeah. I agree entirely with Caroline on this. The point I want to make is that people don't seem to realize that the Trident missiles cannot be used without the permission of the United States.
Exactly.
So the notion it's an independent weapon is a complete and utter joke. And I know where Paul Mason's coming from. I'm not exactly sure where he's going.
And what about this issue that the gentleman at the back had? If you want to leave the EU and then come back in, how long does that take? Is it a different kind of institution when we rejoin?
You know, the sort of fear campaign which has been mounted is a bit grotesque. Because let's say there is a Brexit. There will then be extended negotiations between this British government or whatever succeeds it and the European Union. After those negotiations are complete, and they could take up to 2 years, what is then proposed by the European Union to the British government of the day will then be brought back to the British Parliament and possibly put to a referendum again. So what we are witnessing, actually, is the beginning of a process, not the end of one. And there will be many in the Conservative Party who will say this is final, but it isn't final according to the terms which have been discussed.
And you there's no doubt that it's the beginning of a process, except that it is a very negative process, which is not going to bring about the kind of changes that we need, either on the other side of the British Channel or in this country, that would empower the progressive forces within Britain.
And but do you think they'd be any kinder to us than they were to you, Yanis? Negotiate. Do you think they'd be any kinder to us than they were to you, negotiating
the exit
deal?
Look, there's no doubt that the European Union is going to be extremely harsh on the British, whichever British government comes out, and you're going to end up with a kind of arrangement that Norway has. Mm. There's no way you will get anything better than Norway. And talk to Norwegians. They're really not happy with what they have because they have to make financial contributions to the European Union. They have to accept every idiotic decision Brussels make without the power of veto. And then the only thing they get is that they nominally are not part of it.
They would have to make a real thing of Britain, wouldn't they? A real example of Britain in order to send a message. They're not going to come and give us a really easy ride. I think that's just, you know, Tariq has called us being utopian over this side of the stage. It seems to me to be incredibly utopian to think we're going to get a better deal having put them all through 2 years of who knows how much angst and renegotiation.
Okay. Gentleman here in a jacket. And, somebody over there right next to Mike, jolly good. And guy right at the back, is there a mic? I can't see where the mics are. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. I'm trying looking for women. I tell you what. Oh, no, there's a lady right at the front.
Good evening. Thank you for the very good debate. My question is on Russia. I haven't heard the name Russia being spoken at all. They are... some people say benefiting from what's happening in Europe at the moment. How do you see Brexit in relation to Russia? Would they benefit? Would they not? Thank you.
Interesting. Okay. Should we take the lady at the front? You've got a mic there.
I've got two questions. One of them is about what is going on in Panama at the moment. And given that London is the centre for a lot of financial transactions, my sense is that that's going to affect a lot of things in the future that we don't know. Mm. And the other one is that when I listen to you talking about all of this, what actually comes through to me and I don't understand is it would seem that what we actually need is some kind of international connection of all the views that people put under the left or the 1% or whatever you like to call it. And if you don't address that and you just go to Europe and England, you know, there's Bernie Sanders in America. There's a lot of very interesting things going on in the rest of the world. There's an enormous number of people watching what's going on with that.
So sort of reaching out beyond the internet. Yeah. Beyond Europe. Yeah,
yeah. So okay. I just want to know with Yanis or with all of you, what you would say about that.
Okay. I've completely forgotten where the mics are now. Oh, yeah, sorry, gentlemen there. I remember you. Yep.
Yes, it's actually my question was on Russia and Putin destabilising Europe. So can I pass it to this lady here?
Please do.
It's a separate question.
Please do, yeah.
I am married to him.
That's favouritism. It's fine.
I believe that the future of the UK steel industry is important. Mm. I think Paul Mason does too. I just wondered whether the panel felt that Brexit, in the absence of a fire sale by Tata, would help or hinder the UK steel industry's survival.
Interesting. Okay. Have we got one more mic floating about? Oh, yes, gentleman right at the back.
This is a question to Tariq in particular. I really wondered if you could answer directly rather than saying it's all blown up about fascism or BRIC exit wouldn't lead to lots of other countries leaving and a kind of move to the right in Europe rather than a progressive. I'd really like to understand better your thinking as to why that wouldn't happen. As at the moment, I don't understand your logic.
Okay. It's quite a few interesting things there. Do you want to take that one first, Tariq? Why are you not concerned about the rise of
fascism? Concerned about the rise of the right and the far right in Europe. All I'm saying is that fascism isn't round the corner. You could have very right-wing governments. You've had a government in Italy, not at the moment, which included the lineal descendants of Mussolini, political descendants of Mussolini, in that Italian government for many years under Berlusconi. Did anyone care a damn? No. No one did. It was a pretty horrific government on many levels. Even the Israelis welcomed the Fini when he went there, and as long as he said he supported the wall they'd build, they said, you're fine. So he got the seal of approval from there. So these groups which exist in Holland, in France, in Germany, recently, what are they saying? Of course, immigration, Islamophobia, two key points they make. The third point they make is that we are being deindustrialized, there's large-scale unemployment, the left has sold out completely, don't trust them, they're in the pocket of the plutocracy and the capitalists, and they're getting lots of votes because they're saying these things, including votes from people, which Trump, by the way, is also getting in the United States from white workers. So it's a real problem, and it's something we have to acknowledge is happening. But the way to fight it is, of course, not just to denounce it, but to propose alternatives. And so it's whether you're in or outside the European Union, for me, on that level, is not that important. I mean, one of the problems, if you go to some of the Eastern European countries, which have been included in the European Union, conditions are truly horrific for working class people, male, female, whatever they are. Much, much worse than they've been before, even. And one has got to take this into account. You know, it's part and parcel of that system.
We're sort of broadening out slightly to become a more of a global issue there. And Yanis, do you want to take on this question from the front about there are progressive ideas not just in Europe but elsewhere, and shouldn't we be making a sort of broader alliance with other kind of groups elsewhere?
Well, of course, we are internationalists. And the Saunders campaign is one that many of us are following very closely. I have personal links with it. So the question is, do you strengthen internationalism by supporting Brexit? Or do you strengthen it by supporting the position that we have been supporting, Caroline and I? That is the question. It's an open question. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm necessarily the right and Tariq is the wrong, but this is the issue. There was a question, since we're talking about broader matters of Russia.
Indeed, yeah.
And I'm going to ask a question and just leave it in abeyance, and we can answer it individually. Mm-hmm. Would Mr. Putin be so uppity if the European Union was not disintegrating? And is he going to get more or less uppity if Brexit, in my estimation, speeds up the disintegration of Europe? And I think also in Tariq's estimation. On the steel industry, since there are some interest...
Very good. Yeah.
On the steel industry. Look, let me make the point that it's a large issue, but generally speaking, there will always be industrial sectors that fade as a result of the global redistribution of competitiveness, of trends, the glut of steel, and so on and so forth. But what makes it toxic in a country like Britain today is the low level of investment. You have the lowest level of investment for decades. And when you have low investment, the capacity of your economy and your industry to replenish itself, to shift from fading industries to new industries, to green technologies and so on, is diminished. And this is very important.
But that's a Britain-centric problem, right? That's not something the EU either helps or hinders.
I don't think so. I think that the only way of raising the level of investment is at the level of Europe, to have a concerted policy of coordinating quantitative easing by the Bank of England and the European Central Bank and the European Investment Bank, and have a new investment bank in Britain that works with the European Investment Bank. That is the best bet we have for shifting idle cash from the financial sector to real investment. And finally, on fascism. Finally, on fascism. I have some authority to speak about this, Tariq, because I watched from 2011 onwards, the deflationary forces in Greece, which I believe are going to spread to the rest of Europe the way that I've been describing, produce the monster of the Golden Dawn. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I think it's absolutely pertinent is that our government, I was in government but not in power. Mm-hmm. These thugs are in power but not in government. And it only takes a 6-8% electoral result by Golden Dawn to shift the whole of the establishment in their direction. And I will relate a horror story to you. In 2012, while we still had the Social Democratic Administration, or what was left of it, of the PASOK Socialist Party, which in the end collapsed, in their attempt to hang on to power, ministers of that Socialist Party, the equivalent of the Labour Party back then in Greece, what they did was they gave the order to the police to round up women from the streets of Athens, women that might have been prostitutes or who were homeless, subject them by force to HIV tests. And the ones that came up positive had their mugshots posted on the internet and on television channels, being humiliated and being thrown in police cells. And the only reason why the socialists did that was to appeal to the Golden Dawn thugs. This is why I'm saying that the forces of disintegration, of deflation, of recession, breed monsters who don't have to win elections to be in power.
Did you want to come back and stay with Caroline? Yeah?
Just on the issue of steel, I agree with what Yanis said about investment, but in terms of the impact that Brexit would or wouldn't have on steel and Port Talbot in particular, I think it's worth remembering that it was actually the UK government that was blocking having higher tariffs, that the rest of the EU was perfectly willing to put on to Chinese steel, but actually it was Britain said no. So I think, again, we need to be sort of, clear about that. But on investment too, I think that just takes us maybe into one last point as we look forward to the referendum and beyond, because I think as well as kind of defending or whatever we're doing in terms of what the EU has done to date, looking at reforms that's needed, I think we ought to also have an ambitious agenda of what we would like the EU to do. Mm. And one thing I would love the EU to do would be to precisely use some money through quantitative easing or however else from the ECB and invest that in a Green New Deal, a European Green New Deal, a massive investment in green technologies, energy efficiency, renewable energy, which would create hundreds of thousands of jobs, millions of jobs across the EU. It would get people's fuel bills down, it would create the jobs, it would get our climate emissions down. Mm. So I think let's have a more ambitious agenda. Let's not just think we have to put up with the EU as we have it now. Let's go into that referendum talking about a basic income scheme right across the EU. Why don't we start fighting for that? A minimum wage whereby it wouldn't be the same in every country to begin with, but it would at least would be a floor of standards whereby we could be sure that the EU was going to be a beacon of higher standards, of something that we can aspire to. Let's have this debate to be something that's more positive instead of always looking backwards as well. Okay.
And I'm told that we've just about got time for just two more questions. So there's a lady right in the middle there in the kind of glasses and a kind of orange scarf. And there's another lady at the back in the middle there.
Can I just say you didn't answer the question about Panama?
Oh, very good point. OK. All right, it's because this lady asked two questions, so I think we probably answered one of them and not the other. OK. And lady in the middle there, is that all right? Sorry, mic people.
Yeah, historically, the EU doesn't have a very good record when it comes to war. So my question is, how do you see a reformed EU tackling the military-industrial complex issue, as well as its relationship with NATO?
Okay, yeah. We better take this one as well, just quickly. Yeah.
We haven't talked about human rights. The UK government wants to get out of the Human Rights Convention, the European Human Rights Convention. Mm-hmm. It's one of the countries that is found guilty most often in that court, and is the way of getting out of that responsibility. So what are we going to do if we don't have human rights?
Okay, so Panama and tax havens, does it make any difference if we're in the EU or out of the EU, this great industry that we have here?
No, none whatsoever. I mean, how could it? They're all involved in it. The notion that on this question of money laundering and all this, the European elites are too different from each other is nonsense. The English elite does what the European...
You're right on that.
Yeah.
Having said that, the question is, what is the best way of tackling that, and what gives us more instruments for tackling that? Mm. Is the disintegration of the European Union going to help us bring together more regulation at the global level, or fewer instruments? I think the latter.
We don't know.
Yeah. Presumably the same argument applies to tackling human rights issues, right? Indeed.
On the question of NATO, very quickly.
Yeah.
The problem is, I don't know whether you've noticed, I don't gloss over the scandalous failures of the European Union. You put the words together, European, foreign, and policy, and you end up with a joke. But that doesn't mean that we should disintegrate the European Union. It means we should confront Brussels, and we should try to create a new form of governing Europe against the wishes of the existing European Union institutions, so that you put together those words and you don't end up with a joke anymore.
But the way of doing that is, of course, to kick these institutions in the back.
Yes, I believe in kicking them, but from within, through disobedience and vetoing while staying in.
Caroline, do you like to have the last word?
Well, thank you. So I think that you need European rules precisely when you're trying to tackle things like tax havens. And the European Parliament right now is bringing forward proposals exactly to tackle tax havens, and Cameron is trying to get away from it. So the EU is trying to go further as a set of rules, even if Juncker himself is not. The same with human rights. But I just wanted, if it is the last word, just to say one thing about peace. Because I think sometimes we can, again, be a bit complacent and forget that one of the urges for the creation of the European Union was to try to bind countries together in a way that meant that they were less likely to go to war in the future. And we can have arguments about the way they chose to do that, but nonetheless, that is what they were aiming to do. And I think that however frustrating and cumbersome the processes are at European level of trying to reach agreement between 28 member states, and they are incredibly cumbersome and frustrating, how much better to be trying to reach agreement that way rather than through the bullets and bombs that were on our very conflict-ridden continent not very long ago. And so I think we do forget that of our peril.
How reassuring to end on an uplifting note, because we've heard some quite apocalyptic predictions from all sides this evening too. I hope you've enjoyed the debate. I certainly have. I think it's been fascinating and quite different from the rather dry pro and anti-Brexit debates I spend quite a lot of my time reporting on. So perhaps we could just thank our brilliant panel, Yanis Varoufakis, Caroline Lucas and Tariq Ali.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.